tonight. Dave is filling in, so now I would like to introduce to you a man that everybody knows, Mr. Dave Palmer.
Yeah. Those applause should be kept for Anita. That's what they're for. I'm sorry, Anita. I did not mean to take anything that was yours. In case anybody wants to know, Anita is the Kaiser Soze of Westfield. She always has and always will run everything. So Ari sends her hellos, and she could not find somebody to be here tonight, so she asked me to cover. So we're going to start at the top of page 79. And the first full paragraph. And we're out making amends, if I'm not mistaken, right? Isn't that where she left us with? Wandering out to make amends. Who here has been through the amends process at least once? Okay, so a majority of the room. Who here, by show of hands, really didn't want to go through the amends process at least once? Right. I got to tell you, when I was looking at the amends process, I thought, I'm not doing that. They harmed me more. I don't have that kind of money. I don't like them in the first place, and not until they say they're sorry first am I going to go out there and do that stuff. Of course, I hadn't done inventory yet, so that was just postulation on my part. But it was one of the things that kept me from really kind of embracing the idea that the steps were a requirement. Was this idea that I had some sort of variability whether or not I made amends. Now, I'll tell you this. Nothing so much changed my life as to go out and actually make amends, which requires me to face he or she who I had a problem with, and to then take action, actual action, to fix that which I had done. I'm not going to show up with a "I'm sorry" or something else. Many of these people have heard that from me a million times. I'll finish my amends with "I'm sorry," but that's after I've taken action. Okay, so although these reparations take innumerable forms, there are some general principles we find guiding, reminding ourselves so that we have decided to go to any lengths to find a spiritual experience. We ask that we be given strength and direction to do the right thing, no matter what the personal consequences may be. We may lose our position or reputation or face jail, but we are willing. We have to be. We must not shrink at anything. Which is a very interesting concept. Anybody here besides me face significant prison time if you actually went out and made certain amends?
Depends on the statute of limitations.
That's an excellent point. The point raised was depends on the statute of limitations, right? The funny thing about the steps and the funny thing about the program of action is that two requirements are willingness and honesty. And I had to become absolutely willing to face whatever the consequences were before I would actually find true freedom in this program. There are a multitude of bad amends stories out there of people who have made mistakes with the amends process. The ninth step says, except when to do so would injure them or others, right? So the idea that we just randomly go out and make amends based upon our own thinking, and the problem centers in our mind, is not the deal, right? The deal is that we work with a spiritual advisor, typically nowadays that's a sponsor, to figure out what the action is that we need to take, and whether or not somebody else is going to be harmed. There's a classic story about, not classic, but there's a horrific story about a fellow who got sober, and I think I want to say he was in his 40s, and when he was in college, they had been in a drunken party, and a girl had ended up being molested and raped by three of them. And he got a conscience coming into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and wanted to make amends to her. I don't remember whether that was on the advice of sponsor or not, but whatever the case might be, he ended up sitting in front of her. Now, she had, for the most part, forgotten this altogether. And you can actually I think this happened in 2009. If you do a search on the internet, you'll probably find this story. She had, for the most part, forgotten this or never really was sure if it was real or not because everybody was just out of their minds, you know, at this party. But when he sat before her, it all coalesced for her and became an incredibly painful experience. And she picked up the phone and called the police. And he was arrested and because there is no statute of limitations in that particular state. And they wanted to know who the other two fellows were.
Yeah,
And they have this kind of thing where, like, they make your jail time much longer if you don't cooperate. And I'm not sure who's better off in that situation. You know, I have no idea. I've never been faced with that as an individual in the rooms. I've never been counseled to any of that. I've never had to do that myself. None of that stuff's ever happened to me. But we can muck this thing up if we're not really seeking to do what God wants us to do and be what God wants us to be. There's another story that I tell also, this rapper in New York who had gotten sober, and 20 years earlier he had shot a guy in a robbery. He never knew what happened to the guy, but the guy had died, and he had decided he was going to make amends. I believe this was under counsel with his sponsor, and he went out to make amends and showed up at the police station. They couldn't even find the file. They couldn't find the file. We don't remember this incident. You know, and he went back and said, could you please look again? And they finally found it, and it turned out the guy had died. You know, so he's in jail today, I believe. And his wife would like to know how the hell him and her and the kids are better off today. Yeah. Right? So, this it says, although these reparations take innumerable forms, right, it doesn't mean that we always show up and we pay a bill. You know, I've had plenty of amends where I went out and did something for the other person that they couldn't necessarily do for themselves or didn't like doing for themselves and had to do all the time. You know, I'll handle that for you from now on. You know, or I'll handle that for a while, or I'll handle that in some way. You know, a lot of times I've caused pain and suffering. I mean, you know, past relationships of mine where people have gone, really, Dave? You know, you really sucked in that period. Now, how do I set that right? How do I fix that? Sometimes it's really just a matter of getting out and taking some burden off their shoulders that they don't like right now, or handling something else, or waiting for the right opportunity, but being available to them. The point of this is that there's a level of faith that I have to have. There has to be some sort of idea that I'm going to actually take action that would not normally happen for me, and that I wouldn't normally do it. There was a guy... I had stolen 5 pounds of pot from him when I was drug dealing, and it was 1977. And I was sponsoring a guy, taking him through the steps, and he goes, hey, Dave, did you ever hang out in this town? This is about 5 years ago, 6 years ago. And I said, yeah, I used to hang out in that town. He goes, did you ever know so-and-so? And I went, oh, shit, yeah, I knew so-and-so. Oh, shit, I owe him some money, right? Because I had stolen from him. It doesn't matter what it was. I still stole from him. He had an economic disadvantage. I said, shit, can you get his number? He goes, well, he's not doing real well. I said, what do you mean he's not doing real well? He's on the streets of Newark smoking crack. Well, I said, oh, shit, that's a tough life. I said, can you get me his number? He goes, yeah, I can. Took about 2 months to get the number. Now, in this process, I'm sitting down on the calculator, and I figure the $2,000 I stole from him is worth about $8,700 now. And I go to the wife, and I say, do you mind? I have an amends. It's $8,700. She goes, no, I don't care. Go ahead. I had the money. I had the okay from the supreme leader. And and I'm ready to go off and make this amends, except there's something's not sitting right. I mean, I don't know what it is. I've spoken to my sponsor, and he's instructed me that you cannot go meet this guy. You don't know what he's about. You know, he might pull a gun on you. Then where would your family be? And he goes, give the money to a rehab or something. And I was going into prayer and meditation, and I was not getting anything back. You know, I just didn't know what to do. It was really kind of weird because at this point, I had a pretty active prayer and meditation life, and I was very often able to go into the things that I didn't know what to do with and get some form of an answer, but I'm not getting an answer on this. And I go back to my sponsor. I say, you know, I don't think that's the answer. I really believe that I need to make this amends, direct amends to this guy. And he goes, all right, you want to make a direct amends to him? He goes, go ahead. Just make sure you know how to handle yourself. I said, I still remember how to handle myself. You know, public place, you know, the whole nine yards. I went into prayer and meditation on that. And I was like, still didn't feel right. You know, weird, right? I'm not like... The answer can be yes or no, and neither one works. I'm thinking about it. Finally, I decided, this is about 6 weeks after talking to him for the last time about whether or not I should make this amends or not. I got $8,700 that I want to return from harm that I committed. All right. Finally, Saturday morning, I wake up and said, today's the day. I pick up the phone at exactly 11 o'clock in the morning, and I call this guy. I said, hey, how you doing? This is Dave Palmer. Do you remember me from the 70s? right? He goes, you know, Dave, it's good talking to you, but I really don't remember you. Sound very rational, reasonable, level-headed. He goes, but could you do me a favor? Can you call me back in 30 minutes? I'm doing something right now. And I said, sure. I was happy. I was pleased, you know. And I hung up the phone. And I waited exactly 30 minutes on the watch. At 11:30 on the dot, I picked up the phone. I called the guy. And what he said to me is, I said, hey, this is Dave Palmer. He goes, buddy, you got the wrong number, and hung up. And I thought to myself, the first thing I thought to myself was, I should text him that I want to give him $8,700, right? Because now I'm like excited to get this done.
Yeah.
And I go, no, you shouldn't text him to give him $8,700. He probably just scored. He's probably out of his mind. He probably is totally fearful. Imagine that. I've been in the place where a phone, you ever had the phone ring and go, ha, 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 who's calling? You know, before caller ID. You know, if you didn't drink before caller ID, you don't know the terror. You know, I mean, just, oh my God, who'd be calling me? You know, it could be a cousin or something who wants to talk to you. It could be a well-wisher, but no. I'm sure that phone call is bringing me pain and suffering, and that's probably what he thought about my phone call. Probably, I don't know. So I was left with like, well, I don't know what I'm supposed to do now. I go into prayer and meditation. What do you think I get back? Like, all God wanted me to do was to be willing to be a part of this process 100%. Turn my will and life over to the care of God, regardless of what happened, and just move forward. It'll be okay. I remain willing to give that man the money. I remain willing to take an innumerable form to help this man in any way, shape, or form. I'm waiting for the right opportunity. I don't know what that opportunity is. But I haven't given him the money. I still have the money. I am not unwilling to do it. But I honestly believe at that moment that God did not want me to hand off $8,700 to a crack-smoking, you know, street-dwelling dude. Just harm, we make direct amends wherever possible except when to do so and injure them. It's probably what would have happened, right? Or others. So. But it talks about doing these, we've made a decision to go to any lengths to find a spiritual experience, right? So, what's a spiritual experience for me is not necessarily that I get happy. You know, this is the, let me lock and load on the 9-step promises, right? Because that's what I really want to do is be happy, joyous, and free. So this is all about me. That's not what a spiritual experience is about for me. All this work is about getting them free of me, right? Because I have come down like a sack of potatoes on people's head a million times and left them wondering what the hell they did to deserve me, right? Some of you may know me. I have a strong personality. I can be a bit of a pain in the ass, right? And when I'm angry, right, which I don't think any of you have ever seen, right, I can be a real pain in the ass. And there are people I left damaged in the wake, right? I can't show up and go, you know, I like amends to you, so I'm going to say I'm sorry so I can go out and get happy, joyous, and free now. How different would that be from exactly how I ran my life when I was self-directed, right? Now, the deal is I got to show up and get you free of me. I got to show up and let you know it wasn't your fault. I got to let you know that I'm driven by 100 forms of fear. Maybe I don't get into the details with everybody, but I certainly let you know that what you did, you didn't. What happened, you did not deserve. And then I fix in any way, shape, or form that I can what had happened. You know, that means either give money or take action, but it's an action item. And I do that so the world is better off. A spiritual experience. For me, a series of spiritual experiences will lead to a spiritual awakening. So if I'm actually putting you in front of me, your needs in front of my wants, guess what happens? Right? I start to have an experience with the true nature of this world. And that leads to an awakening. For me. Usually, however, other people are involved. Therefore, we are not to be hasty and foolish martyr who would needlessly sacrifice others to save himself from the alcoholic pit. A man we know had remarried because of resentment and drinking. He had not paid alimony to his first wife. She was furious. She went to court and got an order for his arrest. He had commenced our way of life, had secured a position, and was getting his head above water. It would have been impressive heroics if he had walked up to the judge and said, "Here I am." Who here has come off of an alcoholic debauch, rolled into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, gotten a level of recovery, or had become recovered, found themselves working gainfully, and started to see the bills start to ebb and flow away, and started to have the money to go to movies and, you know, and stopped worrying about the jangle of the phone that would disrupt your serenity because you were paid up on your bills. Who's had that experience in this room where you've gotten jobs after getting sober? All right? It feels good, doesn't it, to not be a loser, right? I don't want to judge anybody, but, you know. I mean, I was unemployable when I came into the rooms in 1985. I was unemployable. I was unemployable. I was in a psychiatric hospital. They don't employ psychiatric patients. And I took whatever job I could. Painting closets for $5 an hour was my first job out of rehab. I had gone from a $5,000 a week career criminal to a $5 an hour closet painter. Because the guy wouldn't trust me, right? Wouldn't trust me to paint the hallway. I probably didn't look that good.
And you do now.
Thank you. And, you know, the truth is, though, that as the stuff started to come together, right, I started to feel like, well, you know, I'm doing this, right? This is coming together. And any threat to that scared the crap out of me. Another reason why, in my early sobriety, I didn't want to make amends. I didn't want to pay that money back. You know, I felt like, you know, I owe $10,000 to Carlos, the Colombian cocaine dealer. You know, $5 an hour is a lot of hours to pay him back. And he doesn't have a payment plan. You know, he does not take a MasterCard. So I can understand, I didn't have the situation, I didn't have the personal experience that the wife was behind, in other words, behind an alimony, right? But I can understand the fear that this newfound, right, freedom from financial worry, even though I didn't really have financial worry freedom yet, but the, you know, the burden was off the shoulders, the idea that I'd have to go back into that, oh my God, I'm going to have no money kind of situation, wasn't that attractive. Who here has found themselves in a situation faced in alcohol, faced in recovery, that they'd have to go and make some real financial repairs to what they had done in the past? Right? Was it hard? It was hard. Was it hard to make the decision to do it? Right, it's a mixed bag. Some people are yes, some people are no. Fear of financial security, right? We can take that back to the seven deadly sins. Why do I have fear of financial security? I don't believe that God's going to provide exactly what I need when I need it. I don't believe it. If I believed it, I would be like, oh yeah, hey, honey, I got some money. Here it is. You know, the alimony guy. Right? But that's not what I do. I get used to that level of comfort. I can finally go to the movies. I can finally take a girl out to dinner. I can finally do this. Right? And I don't want to change that. So I become attached to that which is not mine in the first place. We thought he ought to be willing to do that if necessary, but if he were in jail, he could provide nothing for either family. We suggested he write his first wife admitting his faults and asking forgiveness. He did, and also sent a small amount of money, right? A token of his goodwill and what he was trying to accomplish. He said he was perfectly willing to go to jail if she insisted. That's a scary comment, isn't it?
Yep.
There was a time in my life when faced with a situation, this is in recovery, when faced in a situation that I did not want to have happen, I was willing to give up everything. I'm talking about finances. Give up everything. Everything. Because I knew I'd be okay. The other person didn't take it. Didn't take it. Of course she did not, and the whole situation has long since been adjusted. Before taking drastic action which might implicate other people, we secure their consent. If we have obtained permission, have consulted with others, ask God to help, and the drastic step is indicated, we must not shrink. I have not had the experience of having to ask other people's permission to make an amends. Well, excluding my wife, which is really making the financial part. I mean, I never had an implication of somebody else. And that's probably because of the way that I drank and the way that I acted. I was pretty much alone. I was a wolf pack of one. You know, I just didn't have a lot of friends. I wonder why. Hey, Jim. And, you know, so, but has anybody here had the experience of having to go to somebody else and say, you know that time we stole the Army Humvee and left it in the river? I'm going to go make amends for that. Are you okay with that? Anybody have that experience?
No.
No Humvees? No Humvees in the room?
No.
Oh, just one Humvee.
Yeah, just one.
Just one Humvee. Okay. No, but has anybody ever gone out and had to ask somebody else's permission to make an amends?
Yeah, I had to ask my sister because my other sister, I was making my amends to my other sister, but it would implicate my other sister to be okay. Involved.
Did you get approval to do it or not?
She was okay with it. Yeah.
Okay. Anybody else?
I have it.
Richie?
For sexual amends, yes. Mm-hmm. I had to.
Okay.
When I made amends to the woman, I was told by my sponsor to ask her consent to make it to her husband. So I had that experience.
Did you give consent or not?
Yes, I did.
She gave you consent.
She gave me consent.
Okay. I have that situation looming, but I haven't, you know, gone to the other person yet and asked them one way or another yet. But yeah, it goes to the back of your mind, and it's like it doesn't go away.
All right. These were not easy things, were they?
Mm-mm.
No. So I don't have the experience, which is why I wanted to ask.
I just had a question.
Yes, go ahead.
Does it also mean that to ask permission to the person you just want to make the amends to?
No. So if, let's just say,
I would like to, you know, make amends to you. Is that okay with you?
No, let's say.
Because they could be like, no, I don't want to hear from you.
Oh, that could happen.
That's true.
That's what I thought the permission was.
No, the permission is if I'm going to implicate somebody else.
Okay.
You know, Richie and I stole a Humvee.
Yeah.
Richie, I'm going to go make amends to the U.S. government. You're like, do not, do, you know. They know there's two people. You can't tell them that I did it.
Still want to remember.
Yeah, still remember. So. And the directions are pretty clear. If we have obtained permission, have consulted with others, ask God to help, and the drastic step is indicated, we must not shrink. This brings to mind a story about one of our friends. While drinking, he accepted a sum of money from a bitterly hated business rival, giving him no receipt. Sounds like something I would do. For it. He subsequently denied having received the money and used the incident as a basis for discrediting the man. He thus used his own wrongdoing as a means of destroying the reputation of another. In fact, his rival was ruined. He felt that he had done a wrong he could not possibly make right. Now, I want to stop there. The entire process that we've been going through the book, the entire process that is laid out before us is one where it says that no human power can solve our problems. Is that correct? Does everybody get that?
Yeah.
Right. The whole point of the 12 steps, right, is to get us with God in one form or another. Right. Dr. Silkworth says the problem centers in our mind, and Bill agreed with him. So, right here, he felt he had done a wrong he could not possibly make right. He doesn't say he went to counsel and spoke to a priest or another alcoholic or got on his knees and prayed to God, you know, what should I do here? He made a decision in his own mind. It is absolutely stunning to me how often during the course of a day I will begin to make a decision based upon preconceived notions that had no basis in fact with no guidance from another human being. It is shocking to me how I can sit before you right now. It's actually kind of cool, but it used to be shocking to me that I can sit here before you now and say, probably everything I've ever said is wrong on some level or another, no matter how much I believe it and how authoritatively I presented it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you guys went, yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah, that sounds good, Dave. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
2 days later, something different, right? That's the problem with my mind. Left to my own devices, the same thing. Like, I immediately after calling this guy up and wanting to give him the money, and he hangs up on me, I want to text him and say, hey, come and get some cash. That's me acting on self-directed notions that I want to be the big man or whatever the case it is in this particular case, right? If he opened that old affair, he was afraid it would destroy the reputation of his partner, disgrace his family, and take away his means of livelihood. What right had he to involve those dependent upon him? How could he possibly make a public statement exonerating his rival? After consulting with his wife and partner, he came to the conclusion that it was better to take those risks than to stand before his creator guilty of such ruinous slander. He saw that he had to place the outcome in God's hands, or he would soon start drinking again, and all would be lost anyhow. He attended church for the first time in many years. After the sermon, he quietly got up and made an explanation. His action met widespread approval, and today he is one of the most trusted citizens of his town. This all happened years ago. I'm going to roll the dice here and say that probably nobody's had this exact same experience, right?
No.
Right? No. How many people here have shown up somewhere and just told the truth? And I'm talking about the truth that weighed on your shoulders like 1,000 pounds forever, that made you change every little thing when you were talking about something around that. Like, I shot dope at 90 days in 85 and didn't talk about that for 17 years. I'm never going to do inventory in that case, right? Why don't you do inventory? Because you're supposed to tell the truth? I don't want to tell the truth because I'll have to talk about that. I didn't drink again until 2002. I didn't use drugs again until 2002, right? That lie weighed on, was like acid on my spine for all those years. When I finally put it out on the table at a meeting, my first meeting back in 2004, everyone's like, yay, it was wonderful, yay. I'm like, well, I said, that was it? There's no
flogging?
I was just going to say that. There's no flogging room in this meeting? I should attend this meeting more often. And the funny thing was, 2 weeks later, the guy who'd been running the meeting came to me, pulled me aside, and goes, you know, I had used some whippets about 6 months ago, and I didn't consider that a slip. He goes, I've just reset my clean date. And I looked at this guy and said, you can reset your date? Holy shit, no one told me that. I would have come back into the room as much earlier. Saved the original date by 9 months. Really got pissed. But 90 days, actually. It was 90 days. I was pissed. Just reset your date. Who knew?
This should be the beginning?
No. So, like, if I had talked about it in 5 years, I would have had four and a quarter years. I mean, 4 3/4 years, because I would have talked about having shot dope at 90 days. So I would have reset to 90 days. Because I had been continuously clean from that moment on.
Okay.
I'd been continuously clean from that moment on until I drank again in 2002. Didn't know you could reset your date. Mm. My ego kept me from coming back here because I didn't want to talk about it. This guy walks into church and admits the thing that he knows he can't admit. He knows this based upon his mind, not because there's something that tells him he can't do this. Right? In fact, his wife, most impacted, his business partner, most impacted, said, hey, rock on, dude. Mm-hmm. Right? The things that I tell myself are the things that will kill me. The worst enemy to me in this room is he who knows me best, me. Not you. Right? I don't have to worry about you. I have to worry about what goes on up here when I shut the doors to the boardroom and just let that conversation go on. Right? That's the insanity. Right? And when is that going to come up? That's going to come up when I've got to write inventory and tell the... Maybe not write inventory, but tell you the truth of the inventory. You ever have somebody who gives you a fist up and goes, let me explain this part. So the sheep weren't really part of the party originally? Just read what you wrote when you wrote the inventory. You know, this stuff will come up when you don't want to talk about it or you don't want to take action. That's been my experience. You know, when I don't want to make the amends, oh, Jesus. No, I don't want to do that. I'm going to start to ruminate on my original decision to make that amends, somehow being too aggressive, right? Gee, you know, I'm being too AA making that amends. I should stop that stuff right now, right? The truth of the matter is the problem centers in my mind, and I will continually bring that to the forefront. Happens for me in 4 and 5, and happens for me in 9, right? Usually I'll write about the stuff. Like I'll cop to it in 4 and I'll cop to it in the A-step cards. It's the actual action stuff of talking about it or making the amends that I have a problem with. I end up doing it all the time. I've never left a fist step holding something back. In fact, the first fist step I did with my current sponsor, he was pulling into the parking lot right here and I was going to give him the fist step. And before he pulled over, I ran over to the window and said, and you know I did this because it was the worst thing I'd ever done. And he looked at me and he goes, we can get through that. I said, well, then park your car. Because if we can't get through that, there's nothing to talk about. But what I believe is going to happen isn't always what happens. And the things always tend to work out better. And I'm sure many of you have sat in meetings and talked about something, or sat across from a loved one and talked about something, or sat across from a sponsor and talked about something, or sat across from another alcoholic in a diner and heard them talk about something and go, yeah, mm-hmm, Yeah, I did that too. It's okay. Yeah. No animals were harmed in the making of this amends, you know, just, it's okay. And I can't tell you how many times I've sat in a diner and, or, you know, we're in a car or in a park with somebody else, another man, and had him tell me the worst thing he's ever done. I go, yeah, dude, did that. Right? So it's that sharing, it's that getting honest. Willingness and honesty are indispensable. Throughout this book, you'll see it all the time. Right? Here this man shows up and is honest about something that is just, he had no idea was going to work. And it worked just fine. The chances are that we have domestic problems. Perhaps we were mixed up with women in a fashion we wouldn't care to have advertised. Of course, this was not written before the internet and grainy green videos. So, we doubt if in this respect, alcoholics are fundamentally much worse than other people. Right? So Bill's bringing us down to like in the fifth step where we're at one with our fellow man. But drinking does complicate sex relations in the home. After a few years with an alcoholic, a wife gets worn out, resentful, and uncommunicative. How could she be anything else? Is it possible that what we bring to the table is the worst thing and we think we're the best thing? Is it possible when I show up and I'm just like, how could you not want this? That you're thinking being around you requires a biohazard suit, you know? Not that I've had that experience, but the husband begins to feel lonely, sorry for himself, right? I create the situation where she doesn't want me, and I begin to feel sorry for myself, which is what happened to me. He commences to look around nightclubs or their equivalent for something besides liquor. Well, I know that. Perhaps he is having a secret and exciting affair with the girl who understands. Never met her. She's still out there. In fairness, we must say that she may be understanding, but what are we going to do about a thing like that? A man so involved often feels very remorseful at times, especially if he is married to a loyal and courageous girl who is literally going through hell for him. Now, so this is an interesting comment, right? I find myself in a position where she's not treating me the way I want to be treated. Right? Now, this is based upon my mind taking in a bunch of information and chewing it up and coming out with the idea that she's not treating me the way she's supposed that I should be treated. So then I go out looking for the woman who understands, which apparently is not available in New Jersey. And then I feel like a complete ass because she's a wonderful, courageous, loyal woman. Could you think of a more destructive place I could have put myself in? I don't love the one that loves me. I don't love me. And I feel like a complete piece of shit. In seeking that, which I think will give me relief, which doesn't exist and won't give me relief. Left to my own devices, left to my own thinking, left to my own self-direction, I end up in a place where the most reasonable idea is I'm going to put a gun in my mouth or I'm going to put a glass to my lips. It's really all I got left. All I got left. And that's how I drank in 2002. Right? Bottle of white wine, which always fixed my problems. Never. Never fixed my problems. And it's a terrible place to be when I'm absolutely sure that I'm the biggest piece of shit on the earth. Whatever the situation, we usually have to do something about it. If we are sure our wife does not know, should we tell her? Not always, we think. If she knows in a general way that we have been wild, should we tell her in detail? Undoubtedly, we should admit our fault. She may insist on knowing all the particulars. She will want to know who the woman is and where she is. Ooh, that might not work out well. We feel we ought to say to her that we have no right to involve another person. We are sorry for what we have done, and God willing, it shall not be repeated. More than that, we cannot do. We have no right to go further. There may have been justifiable exceptions. There may be justifiable exceptions, and though we wish to lay down no rule of any sort, we have often found this the best course to take. So I have experience with this. When I first went through inventory in 2004 and amends, in 2005, I was instructed to go out and make amends. I went to make amends to my wife, and she didn't want to hear it. At that time, I was absolutely undeniably willing to say anything. Ruthlessly honest, felt like I needed to put it all on the table. I'm going to roll the dice. I had no idea that I could be harming other people. No idea. No idea. She didn't want to hear it. All right. Maybe she took solace in the fact that I was willing to make amends. I don't know. We've never had that conversation, and I don't think we'll ever have that conversation. But I made sure that she knew that I was willing to make amends, complete and thorough amends. So there was a fellow in New Jersey who had gone through inventory and had infidelity in his path and did not check with his sponsor, but decided that it was a great idea to go make amends to his wife. This is like taxicab confessions. It's not going to work out that good. Anyway, so he should have phoned a friend. Anyway, so he he goes up to her and says, you know, I've had affairs and I want to set this right. And she goes, oh, you've had affairs? How many? Well, with two or three women. Oh, really? Was it unprotected sex? He's like, yes. She goes, oh, good. Because she was an attorney. So she took him to court for putting her at risk, sued him, and brought the women into court and sued them.
Wow.
So I'm going to say that self-direction is probably not the best path when making amends when it comes to infidelity. But once again, counsel with a loving and caring spiritual advisor, could be a priest, could be a rabbi, could be an imam, could be you know, a sponsor, or somebody who actually knows the intricacies of making amends, right, is probably a good idea. Lives are upended. You know, things that could have been avoided weren't avoided. And it was all out of an immense amount of spite, whether justifiable or not, on this woman's part, to bring everybody to task for what had happened. I don't judge her for it. It was her decision. She had every right to do that in New Jersey. Every right. You know? So, things can unfold in ways that we don't want them to. The point of the ninth step is that we're going to make this world a better place. We're going to free those people of the burden of us. We're going to do God's work. We're going to try and be what God wants us to be and do what God wants us to do. Right? There's no guarantee of happiness, although we will inevitably find happiness in the very existence that we might have found unpleasant previously. I have found happiness, extreme happiness, in at times in my life where people said, why aren't you unhappy? You know, the loss of a job, the loss of money, the loss of this, the loss of that, whatever the case, the loss of a wife, whatever the case might be. And I have been very happy. I've been exceedingly happy. It turns out that the places that I end up, I can be very happy in if I'm not with me. It doesn't really require me to have a Rolls Royce or have anything. I could be living under a bush and I could be happy as long as I'm not with me. Right? And by that I mean that I'm as free of self as I possibly can be at that very moment. Right? And then free of self, I'm not worried about going out and making the amends. Our design for living is not a one-way street. It is as good for the wife as for the husband. If we can forget, so can she. It is better, however, that one does not necessarily needlessly name a person upon whom she can vent jealously. Perhaps there are some cases where the utmost frankness is demanded. No outsider can appreciate such an intimate situation. It may be that both will decide that the way of good sense and loving kindness is to let bygones be bygones. Right? And that's like the clean start. We're just going to forget that. For now, at least. We're going to do our best. Just right this very moment. Just right now, we're going to forget that. Maybe we're going to have trouble later on and we'll bring it back up. But we're making a decision in this very moment to forget that. And let it be gone. Each might pray about it, having the other one's happiness uppermost in mind. Keep it always in sight that we are dealing with that most terrible human emotion. Jealousy. Good generalship may decide that the problem be attacked on the flank rather than risk a face-to-face combat. In case you guys are wondering, those of you who are not savvy to the ways of war, flank attack is coming from the unprotected side where there's no defense and an attack is not expected. You always put your troops in the front to protect you, and the flank attack comes from the side. So all that really means is I'm going to not confront you with this issue and make it the primary thing that we're going to talk about this very moment. It may be something that works its way into our conversation over time. If we have no such complications, there is plenty we should do at home. Sometimes we hear an alcoholic say the only thing he needs to do is to keep sober. Certainly he must keep sober, for there will be no home if he doesn't. But he is yet a long way from making good to the wife or parents whom for years he has shockingly treated. Now, I got sober in 2004 and I came back in the rooms, but I hadn't had a drink in 2 years. I hadn't had any drugs in 2 years. Well, I was the most miserable person you'd ever meet. You see, because when I'm consumed by self and I don't have a drink, I'm a rotten son of a bitch. I really am. My kids did not want to hang out with me. The 2004, they were 5 years old, the twins, and my older daughter was 7. Did not want to hang out with me. My ex didn't want to be with me. And then I wanted to save the marriage. I said, what do I do? She goes, go back to AA. I went back to AA. I started to get sober. I started hanging out with all you fun people, right? And I was busy. I was busy in AA. I was busy at work, and I'd come home, and I would think, you should be treating me better, because now I'm nice. Well, I wasn't really nice, was I? I was deflected. I was distracted. I was happier because I was with a bunch of people from Alcoholics Anonymous who were just as sick as I was. And I'd come home and expect things to be different. And they're not going to be that way until I start taking actions. I couldn't just show up and just not be a pain in the ass. I had to show up and be Mother Teresa. My concept of Mother Teresa, which is that I would go out of my way to put things away, to do dishes, to say kind words, to ask how people's day were, things that just I hadn't done in years. Although that was my true nature, was to care, I hadn't cared in years. And, you know, the funny thing was that slowly but surely my kids stopped fearing me, right? I wasn't as loud and aggressive. And they started to forget the guy who was loud and aggressive. And they started to want to hang out with me. And, you know, the ex really, you know, was much happier. A change started to occur, not because I wanted it to occur, but because I was taking action that was by all definition, action that simply spoke about what God had done for me that I could not do for myself. Right? It's the manifestation of getting free of self and getting more God-centered. And I never really, truly realized how shockingly I had treated my ex-wife until the last inventory that I did was in 2014. And I really took a look. And this was years in recovery, years in Big Book and everything else, and there were still vestiges in me. They had become more subtle and more acidic at the same time. They had become, if you looked at them, you could buy my argument that what it was this, but the truth was, it was just another form of me being a jerk. And it was in that last inventory where I wrote this stuff out, and I go, oh, yeah, I gotta fix this. You know, the funny thing was, when we were getting divorced, there was a piece of art that she wanted, and I said, fine. And then I found out, you know, after the divorce was done, that particular piece was worth more than I thought it was worth. I thought she had planned it that way, right? So I'm making her the bad guy again. And then I start getting mad at her, and I'm hating myself for letting her get over on me. Right? Well, how are you? You're an idiot. You're an idiot. You're just a jerk. You're a loser. Idiot. Yeah. You know. And I suddenly realize I'm never going to be free of this until I make my amends to her. Now, I'd done the inventory, but because of the divorce and a variety of reasons, we just hadn't gotten to the amends. Right? So she comes over, and we're talking, and I asked her, I said, did you know that piece... She goes, I had no idea. I just liked it. And I suddenly remembered just like, yeah, that's exactly the thing. That was always her favorite piece. Dave, you're always going to make her the bad person. You're never going to have a relationship with this person. So what I did was I said to her, I said, can I make my amends to you? And I hadn't written the cards, of course. You know, so why? Actually having the amends written out would have been helpful. But I said, can I make the amends to you? She goes, sure. I said, can I do it tomorrow? She goes, this was on Friday. She goes, sure. So Saturday rolls around. And And we're supposed to meet at 10:30 at my house. And I wake up at 8 o'clock in the morning. And what's the first thought that I have? How do I get out of this? Right? I broke a leg. The kids broke a leg. No, they didn't have to break their legs. The dog's dead. Now you have to kill the dog. I thought to myself, literally, about 10 minutes, I was going, how do you get out of this? Look at this. I want to keep her wrong. Right? And that voice, that God voice in my head says, get out of the bed and write the cards. I got out of bed and I wrote the cards. And I went through the cards. I went through my inventory three times. And I read and I reread the inventory and I wrote my cards and I reread the cards and I prayed and I meditated and I was in tears. I was sobbing like a baby. Sobbing like a baby. It was like the stains on the card where the hot, salty, and I hadn't cried like that. And I don't remember when. I put the pen down at 10:02. We're going to meet at 10:30. Almost 2 hours of writing. I had 12 cards. She texts me at 10:08 and says, let's do this some other time. She doesn't want to hear the amends.
Did you break her leg? No.
She didn't want to hear the amends. But once again, God wanted me to be 100% willing to make these amends. Mm-hmm. Just like with the guy that I owed the $8,700 to. Mm-hmm. I said, you sure? She's like, yeah. Okay. She didn't want to hear him. She didn't want to hear him. God wanted me to write him. God wanted me to experience the pain and suffering that I had caused her, which is exactly what I went through in writing those cards. Action is worth an infinite amount of more than wishing. Nowhere does it say wishing is indispensable.
Can I just say something, David? All that crying you went through, all that pain you went through was the beginning of healing, I think, though. Right? Mm-hmm. Did all the healing start to come from all those tears? And all
absolutely. Stories? It was just, it was one of the stepping stones in the process. I had to become willing to be healed.
Exactly. Exactly. So. Wow. Awesome. Yeah.
Thank you, Richie. Passing all understanding is the patience mothers and wives have had with alcoholics. Had this not been so, many of us would have no homes today and would perhaps be dead. And that's true for me. My mom stood by me when I was out doing the deal in the 80s, and I don't know why. I would have dumped me a long time ago. The alcoholic is like a tornado roaring through his way through the lives of others. Hearts are broken. Sweet relationships are dead. Affections have been uprooted. Selfish and inconsiderate habits have kept the home in turmoil. Yep. We feel a man is unthinking when he says that sobriety is enough. Unthinking. If you sit in a meeting and say, well, I got to worry about me first and stay sober, you can tell him, Dave Palmer says, shut up! You got to worry about the other person first. I just stay sober worrying about the other person. Right? When I worry about me, I drink. He is like the farmer who came up out of his cyclone cellar to find his home ruined. To his wife, he remarked, don't see anything the matter here, Ma. Ain't it grand the wind stopped blowing? Yes, there is a long period of reconstruction ahead. We must take the lead. A remorseful mumbling that we are sorry won't fill the bill at all. We ought to sit down with the family and frankly analyze the past as we now see it, being very careful not to criticize them. Why don't we criticize them?
We're making amends.
I've always criticized them. That's what I do before I do my inventory. You know when you write inventory, they say, we're going to construct a three-column inventory, right? I want to point something out. Those first two columns, Jim stole $100 from me. I could tell you that in the bar stool. I had nothing different about that, those admissions in the first two columns, as anything else. Not until we get to the third column that we start to touch base with God and what has actually affected, and in the fourth column where we're at fault. We don't criticize them. I can't criticize you guys. It's never, ever, ever worked for me. And they don't feel good when they hear it. Their defects may be glaring, but the chances are that our own actions are partly responsible. So we clean house with the family, asking each morning in meditation that our Creator show us the way of patience, tolerance, kindliness, and love. And you'll see those words, patience, tolerance, kindness, and love, throughout this book in one form or another. It doesn't change a lot. When you get into 11, you look at what we're asking for in prayer, what we're looking for in 10 on a daily basis to see where we're disconnected with this world. These are the things that we're looking for, right? Love and tolerance is our code. This spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. Unless one's family expresses a desire to live upon spiritual principles, we think we ought not urge them. We should not talk incessantly to them about spiritual matters. They will change in time. Our behavior will convince them more than our words. We must remember that 10 or 20 years of drunkenness would make a skeptic out of anyone. There may be some wrongs we cannot fully right. We don't worry about them if we can honestly say to ourselves that we would write them if we could. Who here has amends where you don't know who the person was? You'd make an amends, but you just don't know who they are. Mm-hmm. It was a cloudy night in Staten Island, 1978. Someday I'm going to say that, and the person's going to go, I was there. Holy shit. Holy. Some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter. That includes people who have died. I wrote a letter to somebody who had died, changed my view of them and myself. Crazy stuff. And there may be a valid reason for postponement in some cases, but we don't delay if it can be avoided. We should be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble without being servile or scraping. You all know what that means, servile and scraping?
Mm-hmm.
We don't turn ourselves into some subhuman person in front of somebody to just make an amends. We're children of God. We walk tall and we walk free. God has done for us what we could not do for ourselves. As God's people, we stand on our own feet. We don't crawl before anyone. If we were painstaking about this phase of our development. So what are we on, guys?
Nine step
promises.
Promises.
We have about 10 minutes, so we're going to go through them. If we were painstaking about this phase of our development, what does painstaking mean?
Extremely careful.
Thank you. Perfect. Extremely careful about this phase of our development. We'll be amazed before we're halfway through. Amazed. We're going to know now here's a key word I didn't see for 24 years in recovery. New freedom. That means I've never had that experience before. I'm not going back to a level of happiness. Yeah, I was so happy in 7th grade. I'd love to get back to 7th grade, please. No. I'm going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. I'm not going to regret my past. Are you kidding me? You know, my sister went to a party, and I loved my sister. We were best friends. I only had one sibling, and that night she was acting a little weird, and I slapped her. I never hit my sister before. She went to that party, and she got killed on the way home driving the car. Right? I carried that for years, this horrible, horrible guilt, and I couldn't, and yeah, how do you not regret that? I finally got to a place where I started talking about it and saying that, realizing that for whatever reason that happened, it's not a happy time, right? But the power of God should be able to get over that. And I was like, yeah, I can talk about that and getting over that, and that could help somebody. And I was getting over that, talking about it, and helping other people. I had a woman with 34 years come up to me and tell me a story about when her daughter was 16, something similar happened. And she'd been carrying it. She goes, tell me about this. And I sat down with her. We were giving a talk up in Canada, I spent the lunchtime with her just talking about it. She said, I get it. I finally get it. Do you want to know something? About 6 months ago, I'm emailing my mom. And I say, you know, it was my sister, the anniversary of my sister's death, which was back in December. Her birthday was December 2nd, and then she died on November 31st or something like that. 1980, something like that. I said, I really miss Lucinda. I said, and I just feel so terrible about having, slapped her that night to the party. I think in some way I must have contributed her to being upset and driving when she was driving home. And my mother was like, I was at that party. She was not upset whatsoever. I never knew my mother was at that party.
Wow.
I'm like, what do you mean?
Wow.
She wasn't upset. She's like, Dave, she was totally fine at the party. And she goes, she went to drive with her buddy somewhere, meaning she probably went to smoke some pot, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're all at a party for a guy who just passed the bar. She wasn't upset whatsoever. I didn't know she was my mom was at the party. And I feel horrible. It's something that she goes, you have no responsibility in this. She goes, how do you think I felt? I invited her to the party. She goes, you can't think like this. It happened. It had nothing to do with you and I. I've walked my entire adult life with that on my shoulders. The book promises me, and now no more. No more. I could never have talked to my mother about it if I hadn't been free of the regret of the past. And it was something that I was willing to talk to her about for many years, but it never came up. My relationship with my mother has expanded in ways that I never would have ever. She's my hero today. I'm a father now, and my kids look at me like I'm an idiot, which I am. And but I realize now that my mother showed me love and tolerance my entire life. From the first time that I got drunk and got caught, to the time that she had to put me into a psych hospital in 4-point restraints. Love and tolerance. Saved my life. Kept me alive. Gave me life and kept me alive. What do you say to that? What do you say to that? Right?
Thank you.
Right. I have this new relationship with her where I tell her that. Tell her that, and I can talk to her about anything now. Things that normally I wouldn't want to talk about. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door in. I want you guys to know this is my experience. We will comprehend the word serenity. I get it. I get it. And we will know peace. I get it. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. It doesn't matter what your story is or what my story is. It doesn't matter whether you've been in 4-point restraints or you got your PhD and found yourself drinking too late into the night. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. No matter how far down the scale, it can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. Yeah. Yeah. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. These are all promises, every single one of them. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. That is true for me. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. Yeah. It's been my experience. Each and every one of these has been my experience. And it hasn't come because I wished I had done the steps. It's because I had done the steps and put myself into the 9-step process on more than one occasion. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. So in this place, I'm connected to God, right? If I'm out making amends, I'm connected to God because I'm taking risks I would never want to take. The intuition, the second thought, the prayer life, that's the thing that comes from this process where I'm fully involved. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. We will suddenly realize. Right? Nothing I've ever brought to the table has ever made my life better. Not a single thing. Everything that I have is a gift. Well, Dave, you're a smart guy. Yeah, I didn't create my brain. Right? Mm-hmm. Dave, your eyesight's really good. It was amazing up until the time I got glasses. Right? No. Well, I went to get glasses and I go, my eyesight is terrible. I was 42 or 44 at the time, and the woman goes, happens to everybody, Dave. I said, no, really, my eyesight's terrible. So she puts me in front of the machine. She spins the dials. What can you see now? She spins the dials. What can you see now? She spins the dials. What can you see now? I said, okay. She goes, let's do that one more time. Spin the dials. What do you get there? Come on with me outside. We go outside, and she goes, what can you read on the street? I said, well, you see that car over there? I said, I can read that license plate. I said, but you see the car down the next block? I can't read that license plate. I said, I used to be able to read that license plate probably just 3 years ago. And then I told her the story. I was out on a farm with these guys, and there was a barn, and the barn was about, I'm not kidding you, the barn was probably about 600 yards away. And I told them, I said, I got good eyesight. And they go, can you see that barn? I said, I see the barn. They go, really? I said, yeah. I said, you see the barn? They go, yeah. I said, you know, on the bottom, they have 4 sets of windows on the bottom. They go, yeah, that's right. I mean, it's their barn. They knew. See, you see the top row? They go, yeah. I said, you got 4 sets of windows up there. They go, yeah, right. I said, do you know that you have 9 panes of glass in both the top and the bottom? Wow. In each one of these windows? They go, yeah. Well, top right window, second on the top floor, the top right glass is broken. Window's broken out. They go, no, you can't see that. Driving off the farm that day, guess what was broken out? So she looks at me and she goes, Dave, you have 20/20 vision in your one eye and it's better than 20/20 in the other eye. She goes, I can't believe what you used to be able to see. I take ownership of this stuff. But it's a gift from God. Everything's been a gift from God. Everything has been a gift from God. I don't bring anything to the table. Everything I've ever brought to the table, all my good thinking, has mucked things up all along. God has done for me what I could not do for myself. I see the truth of my existence. I don't know shit. It's true. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. Some people say, yeah. And I got to tell you something. They're extravagant if you don't believe, right? But if you believe that God, who has all power, is in your backseat, these are not that extravagant.
Right.
They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always, here's a great promise, they will always, you don't hear me talk about this one, they will always materialize if we work for them. Do inventory, make amends. and this is what you'll find out is true. And I'm going to leave the rest for Ari. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now we open it up for five.